Welcome to our podcast at agendadigitale.eu.
In this podcast series, Nick Kelly and Alessandro Longo draw from their years of experience interacting with top leaders from around the globe, asking the right questions to gain deep insight into how technology impacts every person on the planet and why the excuse that it is not your area of expertise won't cut it anymore if we want humanity to move forward. So in today's episode, I'm honored to welcome a very special guest, Suelette Dreyfus, whose experience as an educator and fighter for privacy and internet freedom rights is held in the highest regard. Suelette, a very warm welcome to you.
Thank you very much.
Okay, so to kick things off, I would like to just ask some general questions about you and your background, why you came to be interested in what you're interested in, what makes you tick, why you dedicate your life and time to what you do.
So I started out as a journalist on Australia's largest selling newspaper, which was the Herald Sun. And I worked my way up from a graduate position to having my own round in general news. And then I went to magazines and wrote longer features about technology and other types of technology than IT. So wind power, solar power, micro hydro, energy efficiency. And then I decided to delve a little more deeply and go do a PhD and also to write a book, which I wouldn't recommend doing simultaneously. It's a way to drive yourself crazy if you try and do it at the same time.
It sounds like
I became very interested in technology partially because I got to know a sort of underground community in Melbourne who were part of the early internet, both internationally as well as in Australia. And I really got a glimpse into a unique time and place in this early underground. And I wrote about it in a book called Underground.
And what year was this?
Well, the first version of the book was published in 1997. And that book, which I wrote with none other than the famous Julian Assange, long before WikiLeaks, that took almost 3 years to research and write.
Yep.
It's almost 500 pages, and it's gone through many sort of incarnations since then. So it was republished in, I think, 2001 and 2011 and 2012, and I think maybe there was another couple of editions after that. It's been translated into six other languages, and the seventh, which is Bangladeshi, is being worked on now. Mm. So quite good, quite beautiful, actually, hard copy editions of the book in French and Spanish and German. And it's none in Italian, sadly.
Well, you know, things move a bit differently over here, but we're getting there.
But it's in Chinese. It's in both traditional Chinese characters and simplified Chinese characters and Japanese.
Yeah.
It's
done incredibly well, hasn't it? But what I would say, let's focus on the book in a bit of a later part, because I really do want to delve into that in quite a lot of depth as well. We'll bring it back to some of the technology that you were working on, say wind power, solar power, and then you moved into your PhD, writing a book in the Melbourne underground scene. What specifically drew you to that security and privacy type of area? Was that spending time with this community, or was that something that you had innately anyway, that your interest in protections in privacy? Or,
well, I come from a long line of sort of civil activists or troublemakers, you might want to call them.
Okay.
in a good way. So I had a great aunt of mine of whom I was very fond, who's since passed away some years, but she's Canadian, and during the U.S. embargo against Cuba for many years, she was quite outraged that the children of Cuba were not getting medicines they needed as a result of this trade embargo. And so she literally was about 80 years old and getting on an airplane from Canada with suitcases stuffed full of medicines.
Wow.
She, she was a pharmaceutical running down down to the hospitals of Cuba to help the children with medicines that they needed.
It brings a new meaning to drug running.
Exactly. It's a new meaning. So, and I had great admiration. She lived a very original life. And I guess in some ways that's a little bit of the ambition of the life that I hope I'm leading, which is, you know, when I go, my children will tell me that, you know, yes, Mom, you've lived an original life. So yeah. I became really interested in the technology because I could see the potential of what it would mean, I think, in the future. Not all of it, of course, but some of it. And I had, in the process of writing and researching underground, some very extended discussions with Julian Assange about this. And you can love him or you can hate him, but he is really a genius and a forward thinker.
Mm.
And had a very long vision of how society might become shaped by the embryonic internet. So that made me think a lot about it. He was always, and of course he is still, very concerned about individuals' privacies and privacy rights.
Mm.
And I think in many ways I learned that privacy is a type of human right.
Mm.
And that it's digital age where information is power.
Mm.
And we see that that power is being amalgamated in the hands of the powerful.
Mm.
You know, you have to think long and hard about what is important in terms of preserving individual freedoms and liberties.
Mm.
And preserving those rights at a digital, you know, in the digital sphere is certainly core to that.
So let's go back to Julian Assange. How did you first end up meeting him? I know you mentioned you were working on the PhD in the book. Did you go to any events that he was attending? And how did that relationship evolve? How was Julian Assange, you know, at that age as in comparison to now?
He was part of an online community of people who were sort of the digital curious of that era.
Mm.
And they were experimenters and frontiers people trying to push the edge of the envelope by just experimenting and trying new things. And there were no handbooks. And back then, computer security was a lot of it was really about information hiding.
Mm.
So administrators would have secret mailing lists that they would send out to other administrators in systems that were connected to the early internet. And when they found a security flaw, they would never describe it explicitly. They would sort of hint around it.
Mm.
And you know, hopefully you would be experienced enough to do it. The manuals to some of these systems were impossible to get. You couldn't buy them on the market, let alone download a user manual from the internet as we can today. And so the only ways to get them were to be part of these organizations or to go dumpster diving. So,
yeah. And tell us about dumpster diving.
So in the early underground, computer underground, a lot of these digital curious people would go to the back dumpsters of telecommunications companies, of the manufacturers of large computer systems or, say, phone switches. And they would look before the garbage pickup day to see if any manuals had been thrown out. I mean, they'd also potentially be looking for passwords and logins written down on scraps of paper.
Mm.
But it was a real gem. You know, it's like finding the Library of Alexandria or something. You can find this collection of manuals for some old VMS system or whatever. But this is how
the beautiful treasure paradox of a bin.
Yeah, okay. Absolutely, absolutely. And you know, and so they'd fish it. They'd go diving in the dumpsters and find it and fish it out and then bring it back. And they would meet up in these informal gatherings and share information and trade information. It was pretty innocent trading of information. It's not like it is today, where there's sort of more corporate espionage element to some aspects of that. But they were early pioneers in the understanding that information is power.
Yeah.
And so they wanted to learn everything that they could. I mean, some of this information was available, for example, in university libraries about basic coding or system structures. And I remember actually interviewing a particularly skilled hacker who was never actually caught. He was overseas. He was not in Australia. And I had said to him at one stage, well, it's great you want to learn all this stuff, but why don't you, just go to the library rather than dumpster diving or breaking into systems to actually get this information. And it became clear from the conversation that he really got off on the buzz of being somewhere that he wasn't supposed to be. You know, there was an adrenaline rush that was just really hot, and learning in that environment of the adrenaline rush became, you could become a junkie to that in a way. And it meant that he was more interested in the information, more interested to learn and retain the information better. So it was pretty interesting times. And in fact, some of my academic research I've done in the digital education space has been quite shaped by that period of time. So I've worked on a project over a number of years, which was around bringing primary school age children, sort of grade 5, grade 6, 10, 11, 12-year-olds together across international borders between China and Australia to talk to each other as kind of digital pen pals over a secured social media platform in order to learn the other country's language.
Okay.
And so the teachers would, in a coordinated fashion, say, okay, you've got a project and the two of you have to go do it together. And part of it'll be in Mandarin and part of it'll be in English. But the idea for this project, which has been a little pilot, but quite successful and the first of its kind for an Asian language internationally, actually. The sort of inspiration came from interviewing a number of hackers overseas in that early underground environment in online messaging, effectively online typing, live typing, different and less glamorous formats than you would have on your phone app like WhatsApp or Signal or Telegram today. But using sort of WeChat or other very basic, ASCII style interfaces. But it became clear after interviewing them over many months in these secured anonymous environments, which is why we use those environments, that their English was improving. And I would ask them, and these guys were sort of 16, 17, 18, 19 years old, maybe 20. And I would say to them, oh, are you studying, English a lot or at school or at university? And they'd say, well, yeah, maybe I'm officially studying it, but I never go to classes because I'm staying up all night hacking. I'm too tired to go to my classes during the day. But yet their English was improving, even though they weren't speaking to anyone in their immediate community around them who spoke English. And the reason their English was improving was because they were part of these online communities with people from the UK, the US, Australia, New Zealand. And they were talking about and sharing information about hacking exploits, hacking targets, just tidbits of information on the underground. And if they wanted to play in that environment, they had to know English.
And I guess also vice versa, English speaking communities speaking in the Russian community, Russian speaking community or China, Mandarin speaking community or Brazilian speaking community, isn't it?
Well, yes and no. So I would say there was a little bit of foreign language discussion, but almost all of it was in English. Okay. I'd say 85-90% of it. There was nothing that I ever heard of in Chinese, very little in Russian and Eastern Europe. Of course, that's changed substantially. There was some other European languages, definitely, and Spanish, of course. But primarily, the overwhelming majority of them spoke English. And if you wanted to trade information or learn or read the manuals that, were so precious to understanding how to break into the systems, you had to speak English. And so they were learning it as they went. They're usually pretty bright kids. They were learning it as they went because there was this enormous carrot, which was they wanted to explore systems on the internet that were verboten. And if they could, if they could master a whole set of vocabulary words and grammar, they were going to be able to do that a whole lot better. And so I took from that learning experience, how could you actually do something more valuable for society? and it kind of, that was the origin of this social media method of language learning across international borders.
And so what year was this, would you say?
Well, I mean, the international hacking community was active really from the late 1980s, sort of 88, 89. But the majority of the really buzzing activity was happening in the early 90s, mid-90s. So sort of 91 to 96, something like that.
And let's I want to bring it back to terminologies, because this is something that I guess the general public and who isn't involved in technology or who isn't invested and in the know for in all things security and privacy, there's a lot of confusion about that word hacking and what it suggests. And I think many people still do attach a negative connotation to it and think that hacking is all bad and malicious. Now, of course, it can be for good or for bad, but can you expand on that a bit more?
Yeah, so I mean, early hackers and the term hacking was very much used in the technical community, in the labs of, you know, MIT and Caltech and University of Melbourne, a whole range of places, to mean someone who would come up with creative technical solutions that were thinking outside the box to difficult technical problems. Mm. So when you had a sticky problem, could you come up with a solution? And that was the clever hack, you know, and that morphed into hacking. But eventually the term was adopted largely through the media writing it up in newspaper reports of early computer break-ins to refer to unauthorized access of computer systems, which at that age and time and space were often creative and out of the box thinking in terms of how you would break into the systems. Because you didn't have a manual. You know, you'd sit, if you managed to dial into a computer run by a company that had a dial-in, you might just be faced with a screen where you didn't have a login. You'd have to make it up as you went along, you'd guess. And then you'd get inside, and because you might be someone who was a high school or university student who didn't have access to this sort of information, you'd just be guessing the commands. You'd be at a command line and you have no idea what to type. So you're kind of groping your way around in the dark. And so in that sense, it is a kind of a clever thing to hack your way around that system. And in many ways, a lot of the early hackers from that underground were people who were trying to get access to the early internet, because at that stage, it was quite hard. You know, you couldn't just call up your ISP or your telco and say, get me internet service. You know, the only internet service in a place like Australia was through a university, or if you had a corporate account at a big sort of telecommunications carrier, you might be able to make international phone calls for free, for example. Or there was some embryonic community-based ISPs, but they were small and poorly resourced and sometimes difficult to get accounts on. They were run by amateurs out of their bedroom kind of late at night. They'd come home from work and plug in two phone lines to the to a couple of modems plugged into some computers at the end of their bed.
With the old noise, with the old whirring and beeping and groaning kind of noise. Okay. Yep.
Exactly. And when mom came in at 11 o'clock and said it was time to go to bed, the bulletin board system went off for the night. So.
I want to go back again to we've considered the term hacking, what that means. If we talk about people groping with their way around in systems where maybe they shouldn't be, what did these guys think about, say, law enforcement, for example? And playing devil's advocate, is it a right thing to hack?
So I think a lot of what they did was either didn't think about law enforcement, not seriously. They certainly had a pretty strong anti-establishment attitude. And I think perhaps one reason that there was such a strong underground hacking culture that came out of Australia early on, you know, a country that was very isolated, a relatively small population base, not necessarily with the same level of education as you might have seen out of New England in the United States with all its universities, for example, is because there is this sort of Australian mentality of the anti-establishment, of, you know, of disrespect to the big guy, the tall poppy. And I think to some way that, and also being combined with when you're an island nation a long way from anywhere geographically, you develop a kind of resourcefulness, a kind of ability to, well, say I'll have to solve it myself because I don't have anyone.
Because you don't have that help. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. You're in an island in the middle of the Pacific and you're 10,000 miles from London and New York. And
plus a lot of us used to be convicts.
yeah, exactly. So maybe that helped. But I think the element of the convict culture that contributed to it, you know, Australia is a prisoner's island in the sun for a million years or however the song goes. Yeah. Is that anti-establishment element to it, you know, that, and if you think about that sort of midnight oil, angry at the man.
And for the
music.
Listeners out there, Midnight Oil is, well, for me, it's one of my favorite bands. And I grew up listening to the drummer. They're an activist band who, they fought the system. They fought against uranium mining in the middle of the Australian desert. So, yeah, it's very anti-establishment, anti the man.
And that anti-establishment element has kind of been, I guess, a part of the Australian national psyche since their early convict days. So many of the convicts were Irish prisoners, for example, who had been, sent over from England for minor trespasses, stealing a loaf of bread, transported in the 1850s.
The proverbial loaf of bread, yeah. Yep.
Exactly. So there was definitely an element of that. And I think all those things came together at just the right moment, but you couldn't get access to the internet then. And so a lot of this was also about curious young people, particularly boys. There were almost no female hackers in that era, trying to get access to this kind of brave new world that they knew was out there, but they couldn't get to it except by breaking into a place that would give them access.
It's a fascinating time, and I guess if we move away from that and we focus now on some of the work that you did in emerging markets and working with, say, civilians, journalists, and activists in nation states where maybe speaking against the governing body or the administration may be very detrimental to your health and may result in your death. So stepping away from that, the hacking the amateur scene and more into now the application of its use in some quite grave scenarios and situations.
Yeah, so I had been part of a project that had been done around the time of the book, not far from it, with Julian and others. And it was a free software project that was called Marutuku, but actually eventually was renamed to the Rubber Hose Project.
I like the Rubber Hose better.
Yeah, that's why it was morphed. But the Rubber Hose Project, which Julian named it, was designed to be a way of encrypting data on a hard drive that would allow you to hide that the data was there. So it's one thing to have data security, which is where you can encrypt data so that someone can see that it's encrypted, but they can't see what the content is. It's quite another thing to hide the existence of the data. And what Rubber Hose did is it had what were called aspects, but if you think about them loosely as layers, and you might have a layer that was a recipe for, you know, chocolate cake, and then you might have a layer for a set of reports that were taken about human rights abuses in repressive regimes, rapes, murders, burning of villages. And if you beat someone with a rubber hose who had this a document in order to get the password, they could give you the password for the chocolate cake, and you would never know that there was another layer of files under there that required a different password.
Okay.
And this meant that it would be helpful to human rights groups in the field. I had gone to meet with human rights workers who were gathering information, gathering testimonies about human rights abuses in Sri Lanka and Cambodia and in Guatemala.
Mm.
And in all of these places, you had human rights groups who were gathering very important data, in some cases hundreds and hundreds of cases of abuse, in some cases by paramilitary, in other cases by the actual government or sanctioned by government as repressive regimes, for example, in Guatemala, of the native Indian communities. And in order to get this information and get it out to the world and also archive it, analyze it, preserve it, use it as the kind of well-documented evidence that would eventually form the backbone of the truth commissions that we saw in these places, and potentially criminal charges and cases against
for war crimes, yeah, and crimes against humanity. No, it's and those areas, Cambodia, Guatemala in particular, I've experienced and lived in both of those countries. Ironically, I think we discussed that the first time we met. The reaction to having that kind of information from the militia or from the regime, that's instant death. So it's the most grave consequence to carry around that information.
Terribly grave. And you know, I spoke with human rights workers who were involved in walking, you know, 2 days through the cloud forests of Guatemala to get to these remote villages where. You know, they government forces had not just gone in and burnt the village and killed the chickens that provided the food and livestock, but, you know, also had raped women as a tool of war. It was definitely very much a tool of aggression and oppression, as well as, you know, in some cases, literally, you know, massacring groups of people by burning them alive. So en masse. So really terrible, shocking, horrendous human rights abuses and attempted genocide, effectively.
And as a journalist writing about that or compiling cases, or as a lawyer or an activist, if you compile cases against those people, they're going to be pretty willing to use those same methods on you as well. That's, I guess, the point, isn't it?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. And to be found bad enough to be found with a laptop in your backpack wandering through these hills. But worse still, you know, if that data can actually be opened and seen that you have these files. So those experiences, and, you know, I went to one human rights group in Cambodia and they just had a wall of paper files, literally a wall from ceiling to floor across the whole length of this room. That had the paper files of human rights abuses, of cases of land being taken away, just confiscated by corrupt officials from
From the top down. I remember when I was living there, Prime Minister Hun Sen, who's you know, behind the democracy, if we shall call it that, had I believe it was his minister. Oh, I can't remember which minister, but one of them owned a property development company and had filled in a lake called the Bungkak Lake with sand, displaced 4,000 families around the lake with no compensation. No housing, because during the genocide back in the 70s, 75 to 79, land rights were a complete, it was a complete mess. So, yeah, so very, very familiar with those types of regimes. And I said to
one of the keepers of this data, well, how do you know that this data is safe? How do you keep these reports safe? And he patted the pocket on his chest and he said, oh, because I have the key to the room. And I just looked at him. What? And I lock it at night. And so I know it's safe. And
that answers that then.
Yeah, I'm sure all these people will sleep well at night knowing that data is so safe.
Oh, dear.
So pretty serious stuff. So this software program was the first functional prototype, and actually other things subsequently were modeled on it, to provide a technology-based layer of protection to the work that these human rights workers would do in the field.
So, really fascinating stuff. One big thing that I guess, you know, we're holding this podcast so that we can try and take some of these concepts, which really are concepts and ideas and technological innovations, which are used in a particular field, but it's a very particular field that, say, the average person in the, you know, in Sydney, for example, where I'm from, or Milan, where I live in Italy, may not have any reason to know about or understanding about this. How do you find talking to people when you're lecturing or talking to public or even on this podcast, how do we bring some of these grave circumstances, which aren't so tangible, back to the public so that they really get a true understanding of why this is important and why they should care?
Well, there are a couple of different ways. So at the simplest level, we will have seen, particularly in the last 2 or 3 years, a set of very high-profile data breaches, you know, LinkedIn and Home Depot and I think Target and any number of data breaches where people's private information has either deliberately been stolen or leaked out of an organization, including, for example, the Red Cross in Australia, which includes information potentially about your sexual preferences or whatever, because, of course, if you are giving blood, you have to answer a set of very personal questions that are around that. So these sorts of things are personal and private. There's nothing illegal about them, but they're not necessarily things that you might want your boss to know, or your mom to know, you know, or your friends to know. And so cybersecurity becomes important at the micro level, at the individual level, because we value the private things in our lives. You know, there was a terrific ruling by the Supreme Court in the United States, I think it was 2012 or 13, and it was around whether or not I think the FBI was allowed to put a tracking device on people's cars without a warrant. And the one of the judges ruling on it was quoting a lower court and described how the nature of privacy is around the fact that you go to the psychiatrist, the labor union movement, you go to the synagogue or the church or the mosque. That you may go to the by-the-hour motel. And these are not illegal things, but they're very private things. And they're things that if large and powerful institutions, be they your government or another government or your competitor in business, gets a hold of, they could choose to use it in a way that would be hurtful to you.
Good, very good points. And I think something that I heard, I think it was from the famous Glenn Greenwald in a lecture. He said, when he gets asked the question or told the statement that, well, I have nothing to hide, and that's a very reflexive type of answer that people use when they say, well, why all this stuff about privacy? I have nothing to hide. And I think you mentioned on stage, okay, well, I've asked anyone who's said that, I've said, okay, well, just give me all of your passwords to every single account, even the email accounts that no one else knows about. So give me all of that, and then I'll read through everything that you have. And so far, no one has replied, okay.
Exactly. You know, it is really about saying, well, this is my private life, and you know that information may be embarrassing, or even if it's not embarrassing, it might just be used in some judgmental fashion
against you.
And so many corporations these days are, and government also, become so regimented in the many different tick boxes you have to, you know, be able to get approved on to get or keep a job, that it's very easy for that sort of thing to be used against you, even if you haven't done anything wrong.
Would you mind expanding a bit more on the impact of technology on whistleblowing, and maybe also expand on precisely what whistleblowing is, a bit more of an information for the public who may not be aware of this terminology and what they're trying to achieve, and also potentially in relation to, say, the European Union and Italy and what kind of strides and awareness there are about this this terminology and the impact of technology on this area.
So whistleblowing is really interesting. It's something that's emerged really in the last 20, 25 years or so and increasingly been embedded in law, including in Italy. It is a kind of freedom of expression in that it is revealing wrongdoing. And in fact, I refer to it in my research work as being the right to dissent from wrongdoing. In that sense, it's kind of a freedom of expression. And it basically, from the research, we know that whistleblowers are people who see wrongdoing, usually in their workplace, might be sexual harassment, it might be people thieving from the company or the government, and who want to call it out. And they're often very brave people because it sometimes comes with a lot of risk of reprisal, like being demoted or sacked or bullied. But they see the wrongdoing and they want to get someone, anyone, to take some action about it. Increasingly, we see that there's a focus on trying to pass legislation to actually protect whistleblowers from reprisal. And we see that technology has an interesting role in this because through the provision of both secure through encryption and anonymous through things like Tor technologies, whistleblowers can now not only alert investigators as to the wrongdoing, but also do so anonymously and provide evidence of the wrongdoing, so primary documentation. And that's very important because without that evidence, it's just an allegation. One of the things about Italy that's interesting is Italy passed whistleblower protection legislation at the end of 2017. And it's one of the first very recent, very, quite good legislation. And it's one of the first pieces of legislation in whistleblower protection that I've seen anywhere in the world, which specifically mentions the use of cryptography to guarantee the confidentiality of the whistleblower and protect the content of the report. So this is quite revolutionary in many ways. It also says that they have to provide at least one alternative reporting channel that guarantees the confidentiality and identity through IT tools and security generally. So this is quite a big deal. And in fact, I've been involved in some research evaluating the countries of the EU against 9 international standards of whistleblower protection and legislation. And Italy has come out number 5 out of all the countries in the EU, which is quite a good ranking. And that is because of this really good legislation that's been passed. Now, whether or not the legislation is rolled out and implemented well is always another question.
I was just about to say it's all good and well to have a very strong construct and governance and a framework written down. The implementation factor is always that's the big question. And I guess we'll see if there are any high profile cases moving forward whether these protection mechanisms do actually assist those whistleblowers or not.
Well, it's quite a clever way that the advocacy groups have actually, and I've been involved in a group that was, contributing to this process, gotten the Italian legislation through. And rather than sort of legislating it through the front door, which is quite difficult, they basically attached these requirements to protect whistleblowers onto companies that want to be in a particular category of legislation. If they're in this category of legislation, then all of a sudden their directors and senior employees get extra protections in law. If they don't meet those requirements, then they don't have these protections in law. So there's a very strong incentive. It doesn't mean that every single company will comply with this, but the fact that it's there, it's predicted by some of the private firms that it will end up covering 70, 80, 90% of the companies. That's terrific coverage of the private sector. And many whistleblower laws we see around the world are only covering the public sector. So this is really quite advanced for Italy, and it's a big success story for NGOs and academics and people who have agitated for this law.
Well, time will tell. It's certainly a great first step, isn't it? Just like to jump back to that word whistleblower, because we have had a lot of negative press about it, and you get it's very polarizing. Would you be able to explore? I guess we're going to play devil's advocate and we take some of the recent big cases like Edward Snowden or Chelsea Manning. These cases, there's always a big march and push of the angle that they are impacting national security,
They're risking lives with this kind of information. They've got complete disregard for responsibility. What do you say in response to that, and how do they justify their actions?
Well, so a couple of things. First of all, there have been repeated requests and probes for whether or not, for example, the revelations of Chelsea Manning actually led to any deaths or injury. And the U.S. military, who initially came out when the documents that Manning leaked were published and said, oh, there's blood on the hands of WikiLeaks for publishing them, in fact, has not been able to point to a single case of anyone having their life or limb put in danger or harmed as a result of it. So there's no actual evidence that that is the case. And I've certainly seen no evidence in the Snowden revelations either. So yes, the big high profile whistleblowers are, you know, when we think of them in the media, we often think of them about being national security, but those aren't the only things. I mean, we see whistleblowing of corruption on Wall Street, a major case in Spain of whistleblowing that was around a local Ana Garrido's case, a local council worker revealing whistleblowing, which then spread, you know, and was revealed to be a whole national network, and now has brought down effectively the prime minister of Spain, who's had to resign over the corruption. I think the question is, you know, is the information being disclosed damaging to an organization? Yes, but most whistleblowers are actually still terribly loyal to their organization. So academic research shows that they're often really just trying to get some of the wrongdoing addressed in some fashion. And their desire is primarily, overwhelmingly, in fact, to try and blow the whistle internally first. But often the corruption will go straight to the top of the organization. And therefore, it's impossible for them to get any solution to the problem. And that's when they have to go externally. And you could argue that the revelations that came out of Chelsea Manning's disclosure, you know, led to a much greater international understanding of the fact that two wars in Iraq and Afghanistan were not going so well, that the public was being fed a lie about, you know, oh, well, the war, we're winning the war and it's almost over. Well, no, actually, it's a fog of war. It wasn't almost over and things weren't going so fabulously. And, you know, as we know from some analysis from Iraq Body Count, the British NGO who studied deaths from the Iraq War, there was something like 120,000 civilian deaths from the Iraq War. I think more than something like 20,000 of which hadn't been documented before. So this is really important stuff because it's the kind of decision that the public has to know about. I mean, you can't go to war in the public's name if they don't understand what the costs are that are being incurred. And in that extent, the national security whistleblowers are really quite important.
Yeah, absolutely. That's really interesting information. I certainly like for the listeners in Italy, especially to hear that they're I guess at what the forefront of developing proper legislation to protect these people who, as polarizing as the subject matter may be, are trying to feed the truth and lift the the veil of the a lack of transparency on sometimes extremely impactful areas.
So if I can say the way to really view whistleblowers is I think of them as the ethical temperature takers in our society. They tell you when the patient, the society, is ill. And when that ethical temperature is not what it should be, they rally to the call to fix it. And one of the measures of how far society has advanced in the progress of civilization is how we treat these people who speak up about wrongdoing. And we have a ways to travel on that one yet.
Well, certainly we do.
Welcome to our podcast at agendadigitale.eu.